Paul Kennedy. Welcome to Ideas. All this week, the 2009 CBC Massey Lectures, The Wayfinders, Why Ancient Wisdom Matters in the Modern World by Wade Davis. The CBC Massey Lectures began in 1961, and over the years these broadcasts have become a place where the best minds of our time discuss the issues that face and as citizens of the world. The three partners in this great enterprise are CBC Radio, Massey College in the University of Toronto, and House of Anansi Press, publisher of the book of the lectures. In earlier years, the Masseys were recorded in a radio studio, but 7 years ago we took the lectures out of the studio and onto the road, so the lectures you're hearing this week were all recorded in front of a live audience, this year in Yellowknife, Vancouver, Halifax, Montreal, and Toronto. The 2009 CBC Massey lecturer is anthropologist, filmmaker, and writer Wade Davis, whose curiosity and researches have ranged from zombies in Haiti to sacred plants in South America. Among many books, he's the author of The Serpent and the Rainbow, which was made into a movie, and One River, nominated for the Governor General's Award. A child raised to believe that a mountain is the abode of a protective spirit, says Wade Davis, will be a profoundly different human being from a youth brought up to believe that a mountain is an inert mass of rock ready to be mined. The full measure of a culture embraces both the actions of a people and the quality of their aspirations, the nature of the metaphors that propel them onward. From Pollock Hall in Montreal, here's Wade Davis with Sacred Geography, the fourth of the 2009 CBC Massey Lectures.
In a rugged knot of mountains in the remote reaches of northern British Columbia lies a stunningly beautiful valley known to the First Nations as the Sacred Headwaters. There, on the southern frontier of the Spatsizi Wilderness, the Serengeti of Canada, are born in remarkably close proximity three of Canada's most important salmon rivers, the Skeena, the Nass, and the Stikine. In a long day, maybe two, it's possible to walk through open meadows following the tracks of grizzly, caribou, and wolf, and drink from the very sources of three rivers that inspired so many of the great cultures of the Pacific Northwest, the Gitxsan and Wet'suwet'en, the Carrier and Secchene, the Tsimshian, Haisla, Tlingit, and Tahltan. Keep on for another 3 days and you get to the headwaters of the Finlay, itself the source of the Mackenzie, Canada's greatest river of all. The only other place I know in my experience where such a miracle of geography occurs is in Tibet, on the slopes of Kailash, where are born the three great rivers of the subcontinent, the Indus, the Brahmaputra, and the Ganges, vital arteries of life that bring a way of being to over a billion people who live downstream. Revered by Hindu, Buddhist, and Jain, Kailash is considered so sacred that no one is allowed not only to climb it, no one is allowed to set foot on it. The thought of violating its flanks with industrial development would represent for all peoples of Asia an act of desecration beyond all imaginings. Anyone who would even dare propose such a deed would face the most severe of sanctions, both in this world and in all worlds to come. In Canada, however, we treat the land rather differently. Against the wishes of all First Nations, the government of British Columbia has opened the sacred headwaters to industrial development. Now, these are not trivial initiatives. Imperial Metals Corporation proposes an open-pit copper and gold mine processing 30,000 tons a day on the flank of Todigan Mountain, home to one of the largest populations of stone sheep in the world. Its tailings pond, if constructed, would drain directly into the headwater lake chain of the Iskut River, the principal affluent of the Stikine. Two other mining concerns would tear into the sacred headwater valley itself on a similar scale, with open-pit anthracite coal operations that would level entire mountains. Environmental concerns totally aside, Think for a moment what these proposals imply about our culture. We accept it as normal that people who have never been on the land, who have no history or connection to the country, who have never felt the pain of a cold winter or the promise of a bright spring, may legally secure the right to come in and, by the very nature of their enterprises, leave in their wake a cultural and physical landscape utterly transformed and desecrated. What's more, in granting such mining concessions, often initially for trivial sums of money to speculators from distant cities, companies cobbled together with less history than my dog, we place no cultural or market value on the land itself. The cost of destroying a natural asset or its inherent worth, if left alone and intact, has absolutely no metric in the economic calculations that support the industrialization of the wild. In this, the fourth of these Massey lectures, I'd really like to reflect on this particular attitude of ours, which is firmly rooted to our culture, which does not exist outside of time and history, but is simply one way of organizing economic behavior, human thought, spiritual intuitions. I'd like to try to suggest that there are indeed, when looked through the anthropological lens, utterly other ways of thinking, other options, any number of different ways of human beings orienting themselves in place, landscape, and home. Now, to step back for a minute, we have to recall where this all came from. During the Renaissance and well into the Enlightenment, in our quest for personal freedom, we in the European tradition clearly liberated the human mind from the tyranny of absolute faith, even as we freed the individual from the collective, which in fact was a sociological equivalent of splitting the atom. And in doing so, we also abandoned many of our intuitions for myth, magic, mysticism, and perhaps most importantly, for metaphor. Well, for several centuries, the rational mind has been ascendant, even though science, its finest expression, can still, in all of its brilliance, only answer the question, how, but never come close to addressing the ultimate question, why. The inherent limitation of the scientific model has long provoked a certain existential dilemma in so many of us, taught since childhood to believe simply that the universe is something to be understood as merely the random action of minute atomic particles spinning and interacting in space. But more significantly, the reduction of the world to a mechanism, with nature but an obstacle to overcome, a resource to be exploited, has in good measure determined the very way in which our cultural tradition has interacted with a living planet. As a young man growing up in British Columbia on the coast, I was led to believe that the rainforests of home existed to be cut. That was the essence of the ideology of scientific forestry that I learned in school and that I practiced in the woods as a logger. Now, this cultural perspective was profoundly different from that of the First Nations, those living on Vancouver Island at the time of European contact and still thriving to this day. If I was sent into the forest to cut it down, a Kwakwaka'wakw youth of similar age was traditionally dispatched during his Hamatsa initiation into those same forests to confront Hukuk and the Crooked Beak of Heaven and the cannibal spirits that dwelt at the north end of the world, that he might be able to bring back the wisdom of the wild into the collective in the potlatch to inspire all of the living and to revitalize the people with the very energy of the natural world. Now, the point is not to ask or suggest which perspective is right or wrong. Is a forest merely cellulose and bored feet? Was it truly the domain of the spirits? Is a mountain a sacred place? Does a river really follow the ancestral path of an anaconda? Who is to say? But ultimately, these are not the important questions. What matters is the potency of the belief and the manner in which the conviction plays itself out in the day-to-day lives of a people. For this, in a very real sense, determines the ecological footprint that any particular culture will have on the earth and its environment. A child raised to believe that a mountain is the abode of a protective spirit will be a profoundly different human being from a youth brought up to believe that a mountain is simply a pile of inert ore ready to be mined. A boy raised to revere the coastal rainforest as the realm of the divine will be a different person from a child taught to believe that such forests are destined to be logged. The full measure of a culture embraces both the actions of its people and the quality of their aspirations, the nature of the metaphors that propel them onward. So here, I think, in a sense, lies the essence of the relationship of indigenous people that I've experienced and the natural world. There's no sentimentality or nostalgia involved. Life in the malarial swamps of the Sepik River in New Guinea, in the chill winds of Tibet, the white heat of the Sahara, leaves little room for sentiment. Nostalgia is not a trait normally associated with the Inuit. Nomadic hunters and gatherers in Borneo have no conscious sense of stewardship for mountain forests they lack the technical capacity to destroy. But what these cultures have done is to forge through time and ritual a relationship with the earth that's based not on a self-conscious notion of being close to it, but on a far more subtle intuition, the idea that the earth itself only exists because it's breathed into being and filtered through the human imagination. Mountains, rivers, and forests are not perceived to be inanimate, mere props on a stage upon which the human drama unfolds. For these societies, the land is literally alive, a dynamic force to be embraced and transformed by the human imagination. Now, this sense of belonging, this sense of connection, which is what I really want to share with you tonight, is, I think, nowhere more perfectly elaborated than along the spine of the Andean Cordillera in South America and in the heights of the Sierra Nevada de Santa Marta, an isolated volcanic massif that soars to 6,000 meters out of the coastal plain of Colombia. And this notion finds its most abstract and consequential expression in the exquisitely subtle philosophy of the Aboriginal peoples of Australia. And these are the places and the worlds that I want to take you to tonight. I first traveled south through the Andes in the spring of 1974 when, as a young student, I was fortunate to join a botanical expedition charged with the task, a remarkable task at the time, of unraveling the mysteries of a plant that was known to the Inca as the divine leaf of immortality, coca, the notorious source of cocaine. It was, as you can imagine, in the 1970s, a rather remarkable assignment. Coca was revered in the Andes as no other plant. In the time of the Inca, no holy shrine could be approached if one did not have coca in the mouth. Unable to cultivate it at the elevation of the imperial capital of Cusco, the Inca replicated it in gold and silver leaf in fields that colored the landscape. To this day, no significant event happens in the Andes without a reciprocal exchange of the energy of the leaf with the essence of Pachamama, the feminine earth essence. No field can be planted or harvested, no child brought into the world, no elder led into the realm of the dead without the mediation in some manner of this sacred plant. So with coca as my lens, the richness of contemporary Pan-Andean life came slowly into focus. For the people of the Andes, the land is literally alive. The mountains are mystical beings that gather the rain, create weather, bring fertility to the soil, abundance to the fields, or, in their wrath, sow destruction and chaos, unleashing deadly storms or frosts that can destroy in mere moments the labor of a year, as indeed occurred in 1983 when a hailstorm in 15 minutes wiped out the entire maize crop of the Cusco region. Every community, every hamlet, every village is still dominated by a specific mountain deity, a protective apu that directs the destiny of all those born in its shadows. Thus, with each step of every day, the people walk through a landscape they literally, in the fiber of their being, take to be sacred. And just as the traditional agricultural economy remains based on the exchange of labor, so too reciprocity defines the connection between the community and the land. Ritual obligations and relationships never spoken about and never forgotten. Pachamama and the Apus will nurture a people as long as they in turn are treated with proper care and reverence and respect. When men and women meet on a trail, they pause and exchange quintus of coca, three perfect leaves aligned to form a cross. Turning to face the nearest Apu, they bring the leaves to their mouths and blow softly, a ritual invocation that sends the essence of the plant back to the earth, the community, the sacred places, and the souls of the ancestors. The exchange of leaves in this sense is a social gesture, a way of acknowledging a human connection. But the blowing of the puke, as it's called, is an act of spiritual reciprocity. For in giving selflessly to the earth, the individual ensures that in time, the energy of the coca will return full circle, as surely as rain falling on a field will inevitably be reborn as a cloud. Now this subtlety of gesture, something that happens a thousand times every day in the mountains of southern Peru, is in its own way a prayer celebrated on a grand scale in every community in these remarkable annual events that are based on rituals of commitment and engagement. Much of what I know of the Andes, I learned in a small community called Chinchero, a stunningly beautiful valley just outside of Cusco. It was the site of the summer palace of Topa Inca Yupanqui, the second of the three great Inca rulers, and it is a stunningly beautiful place. But once each year, at the height of the rainy season, a remarkable event occurs known as the Mujun Umiento, the annual running of the frontiers. The fastest boy in every hamlet is given for one day the honor of becoming a transvestite, a wailaka. Dressed in the clothing of his sister or his mother and carrying ritual white banners, the wailakas must lead all able-bodied men on a run. But it is not your ordinary run. The distance traveled is only 30 kilometers, but the route crosses two soaring Andean ridges. It begins at 3,500 meters of elevation in the village plaza, drops 400 meters in elevation to the ruins, through the ruins to the base of the sacred Apu of Chinchero, which is known as Antakilka, and then ascends at a full run 1,000 meters to the summit spur before falling away to the sacred valley on the other side, only to climb once more to reach the grasslands of the divide and the long trail home. It is a race, but also a pilgrimage. For the boundaries are marked by mounds of earth, holy sites where coca is consumed and given to the earth, libations of alcohol blown to the wind, and the wailaka must dance, spinning in a rhythmic vortex that draws to the sacred peaks the feminine essence and energy of all the women left behind with the children in the villages far below. With each ritual gesture, the runners lay claim to the earth. And this is the essential metaphor. One begins the day as an individual. One begins running as a solitary being. But through exhaustion and sacrifice, remembering that the word sacrifice means in Latin to make sacred, the individual emerges, fused to a single pulse, a single community that through ritual gesture has proclaimed its sense of belonging and once again, for another year, secured its place in sacred geography. A year or so after running the boundaries with Wailaka, I traveled with my good friend Nilda Kalanaupa and a large contingent from Chinchero to a sacred valley known as the Sinicara, site of the Koyariti Festival, the Star Snow Pilgrimage, perhaps the most arduous and spiritually illuminating of all Andean ritual events. Located about 130 kilometers east of Cusco, the Sinicara Valley, the site of the Koyariti, is charged with metaphysical power. It opens to the west to the flank of Ausangati, the most sacred Apu of the Inca. Aligned with Cusco in both cosmological space and time by the Seki lines, It also marked the border between two quadrants of the empire known as Tehuantinsuyul, the four quarters of the world. To the south and east was Colosuyul, embracing the Altiplano of Bolivia, Titicaca, and all the mountains of the sun. North and east is Antisuyul, the cloud forests and tropical lowlands, the one part of the world that the Inca never truly dominated. Thus, the central opposition in Incaic cosmology and thought, upper and lower, mountain and forest, civilized and savage, is played out in ritual when the pilgrims arrive at the Sinicata from all points in the horizon to honor the Lord of Coyariti.
You're listening to Ideas in Canada on CBC Radio 1, on Sirius Satellite Radio 137 across North America and around the world on cbc.ca. I'm Paul Kennedy. The indigenous peoples of the world, says Wade Davis, embrace the natural world in ways that can teach us how we might better look at our own resources as a trust rather than as a possibility for exploitation. From Pollock Hall in Montreal, Sacred Geography, the fourth of the 2009 CBC Massey Lectures.
Now, for most of the year, the Sinicata Valley and the sanctuary lie still and alone, visited only by the odd shepherd. But for 3 days, between the movable feasts of the Ascension and Corpus Christi, as the Pleiades, the seven sisters, reemerge in the night sky, as many as 40,000 pilgrims from all over the Andes converge at the base of the mountain, some arriving on foot, some by mule, others in open trucks and buses. From the small village at the end of the road, the narrow traffic of pilgrims slowly makes its way up a trail that climbs steadily for 9 kilometers, a route that is marked by stone altars and cairns, the stations of the cross where men and women pause and make offerings. Each carries a bundle of small stones, the symbolic burden of sin, to be lightened step by step as one comes closer to the heart of the divine. Above the skyline to the west hovers the shadow of Osungati. All the communities of the southern Andes are represented, jungle dancers from Paucartambo, groups from Puno and Titicaca, the plains of Antacusco and the sacred valley of the Urubamba. Mules and donkeys carry food and supply, but all people must walk, even the crippled who drag their broken bodies up the trail, inch by inch, foot by foot. At 4,800 meters, the air is cold, even with a bright sun, yet the Sinicata, reached in several hours, feels warm from the presence of so many pilgrims and devotees. The atmosphere is utterly festive and profound. It almost feels like a kind of Andean Woodstock, a pageant of color and prayer and dance and song. Ritual banners and flags decorate the hillsides, which appear to almost vibrate in the wind. Along the valley floor, every community sort of stakes its ground, and blankets and ponchos of a dozen hues suddenly begin to form a quilt that spreads along each side of the stream that runs through the valley. Jungle warriors or chunchos, they wear these amazing headdresses festooned with parrot feathers and tunics dyed crimson with cochineal. The mountains are embodied in the pablitos, masked men from all the highland communities, hundreds of tricksters dressed as bears and charged with keeping the peace, controlling the crowds, and performing the most essential of all the rituals. Now, these symbolic embodiments of mountain and jungle, the chunchus and the pablitos, meet in mock struggles, theatrical set pieces that recall ancient battles, real and imagined, and recreate in dance the constant tension that exists between the two opposite positional poles of Andean existence, light and darkness, day and night, sun and the moon. As the men dance and bluff, pose and posture, the women, of course, do what women do best, the things that are important. They gather inside the sanctuary, which glows with the light of thousands of candles, many of them the height of a small child. By dusk, a pail of smoke hovers over the meadows. There's a constant cacophony of brass bands, flutes, harps, and drums, the high falsetto voices of the dancers, and the explosion of fireworks. For 3 days and nights, no one sleeps. The very ground shakes with the movement of the dancers and the slow throbbing tone of the ritual processions. According to Incan mythology, the Pablito is the offspring of a woman and a bear, a supernatural creature uniquely empowered to confront and defeat the condenados. Thus it falls upon them with their high-pitched voices and masked faces to perform the most dangerous and solemn act of the coyote. Like Christ himself, they must bear the burdens of the cross. And as processions of pilgrims carry the statues of saints through the valley, the Pablitos, after a moonlight vigil, lift the crosses from their village churches and carry them 1,000 meters up onto the flanks of the Colcapunca Glacier, where they implant them in the ice that they can be charged with the energy of the mountain and the earth. Then, before dawn, on the third day, roped together by whips, they climb back to the ice to retrieve the crosses as far below tens of thousands of pilgrims kneel in silent prayer. All eyes are on the summit in homage to the Apu. To the west, Ausangati is the first mountain to glow with the rays of dawn. The light moves slowly down its flanks and gradually fills the lower valleys. And once the sun comes up, the crosses come down and make their way on the backs of the Pablitos, down through the Sinicara, out through the pass, into the trucks that will carry them back to the villages. The men also carry from the mountain blocks of ice, which in a sense completes the devotional cycle. The people go to the heights of the mountains to make prayers and pay homage to the Apus, to the divine. In the form of ice, the essence of the mountain returns to the family, to the community, to bring life, fertility to the fields, well-being to the families, health to the animals. The entire ritual, played out over 3 days, prepared for over the course of an entire year, is a constant living dynamic relationship between people, the mountains, and the gods, a reciprocal trinity of trust and renewal, a collective prayer for the cultural survival of the entire Pan-Andean world. Now, if in the southern Andes these original intuitions may be sensed in ritual, distilled from the crucible of 5 centuries of Christian influence and domination, there is one place in South America where the pre-Columbian voice remains direct and pure, unfettered, unfiltered by anything save the slow turning of the world. In a blood-stained continent, the Indians of the Sierra Nevada de Santa Marta were never fully conquered by the Spanish. Descendants of an ancient civilization known as the Tairona, which occupied the entire Caribbean coastal plain of Colombia, the people of the Sierra Nevada today, numbering roughly 30,000, 3 major indigenous groups, the Kogi, the Arawakos, and the Wiwas, long ago escaped death and pestilence to settle in this mountain retreat, this paradise that soars 6,000 meters above the Caribbean coastal plain of Colombia. There, over the course of 5 centuries, they were inspired by an utterly new dream of the earth, a revelation that affirmed the existence of eternal laws that balanced the baroque potential of the human spirit and mind with all the forces of nature. These 3 people, Kogi, Arawako, and Wiwa, separated by language but closely related by myth and memory, share a common adaptation and the same fundamental religious convictions. To this day, they remain true to their ancient laws, the moral, ecological, cosmological, and spiritual dictates of Sarankwa and the Great Mother. And they are still led and inspired by a ritual priesthood of mamos, sacerdotes. They believe and acknowledge explicitly that they are the guardians of the world and that their rituals maintain the balance of life. When the mamos speak, they instantly reveal that their reference points are not of this world. They refer to Columbus as if his arrival was a recent event. They talk of the Great Mother as if she were alive, and for them, she really is, resonant and manifest in every instant in their concept of something they call aluna, a word that translates as water, earth, matter, generative spirit, life force. For the people of the mountains, what is important, what has ultimate value, what gives life purpose, is not what is measured or seen, but what exists in the realm of aluna, the abstract dimension of meaning. The nine-layered universe, the nine-tiered temple, the 9 months a child spends in its mother's womb are all reflections of divine creation, and each informs the other. Thus, a liana is also a snake, the mountains a model of the cosmos. The conical hats worn by the Arawako men represent the snowfields of the sacred peaks. The hairs on a person's body echo the forest trees that cover the mountain flanks. Every element of nature is imbued with higher significance. They do not speak in metaphor. They believe these ideas to be literally true, such that even the most modest of creatures can be seen as a teacher, and the smallest grain of sand is for them a literal mirror of the universe. In their cosmic scheme, people are vital, for it is only the human heart and imagination that allows the Great Mother to become manifest. For the Indians of the Sierra Nevada, people are not the problem, but the solution. They call themselves the Elder Brothers, and they consider their mountains to be the heart of the world. We outsiders, who threaten the earth through our ignorance of the sacred law as they see it, are dismissed as the younger brothers. Now, in many ways, the homeland of the Kogi, the Arawakos, and the Wiwa is indeed the microcosm of the world, and thus metaphorically its symbolic heart. The Sierra Nevada de Santa Marta is the highest coastal mountain formation on Earth. Geologically utterly disconnected from the Andes, which form the Colombian frontier with Venezuela further to the east, the Sierra floats on its own tectonic plate, roughly triangular in shape, roughly 150 kilometers to each side, attached to the South American continent, but separated from it by rift valleys that surround it on every side. According to their myths shared by all three people, the mountains were dreamed into existence when the Great Mother spun her thoughts and conceived the nine layers of the universe. To stabilize the world, she thrust her spindle into its axis and lifted up the massif of the mountains. Then, uncoiling a length of cotton thread, she delineated the horizons of the civilized world, tracing a circle around the base of the Sierra Nevada de Santa Marta, which she declared to be the homeland of her children. Now, this primordial act of creation is never forgotten. The loom and the act of spinning, the notion of a community woven into the fabric of a landscape, are for the people of the Sierra vital and living metaphors that literally guide and direct their lives on a daily basis. They survive as farmers, and in order to exploit the various ecological zones of their homeland, they're constantly on the move, harvesting manioc and maize and coffee, sugar and pineapples in the hot lowlands, planting potatoes and onions in the cold mist of the cloud forest, climbing higher still to graze cattle and gather thatch. But amazingly, they refer to their periodic wanderings up and down this ecological gradient as threads, with the notion that over time a community lays down literally a protective cloth, a cloak upon the earth. When they establish a garden, the women sow the southern half by planting in rows parallel to the sides of the plot. The men, responsible for the northern half, establish rows perpendicular to those laid down by the women, such that if the two halves are folded one on top of the other, what will emerge is a fabric. The garden is seen as a piece of sacred cloth. Those charged today with the duty of leading all human beings in the ways of Sarankwa are the mamos, the priests, and their religious training is intense. The young acolytes are taken away from their families at the age of 2 and 3, and then sequestered in a shadowy world of darkness inside the sacred temple or in its immediate environs for 18 years. Two periods of 9 years that explicitly recall the 9 months of gestation that a child spends in its natural mother's womb. And after this arduous transformation, the young man is taken out of the shadowy world of darkness and taken on pilgrimage from the sea to the ice, from the cloud forest up through the rock and tussock grass to the Paramo, the gateway to the heart of the world. For the very first time in his life, as a teenager, a man perhaps of 18, he sees the world not as it has existed in his imagination, but as it exists in all of its reality and all of its stunning beauty. And the message from the Mamo is clear: this is your world, and it's your world to protect. And so from the coast he carries cotton, shells, and the pods of tropical plants to make pagamientos, or payments, at the high sacred lakes where the wind is the breath of the Great Mother, and spirit guardians dwell, those with the responsibility of enforcing her laws. The offerings preserve life in all of its manifestations. The pure thoughts of the pilgrims are seen as seeds. From the Paramo, the initiate gathers to take back to the sea herbs and the leaves of espelitia, a plant known in Spanish as the friar, because seen from a distance, it can be mistaken for the silhouette of a man, a wandering monk lost in the swirling clouds and mist. Pilgrimage, movement through landscape, is for the elder brothers a constant gesture of affirmation that binds together humans and nature in this single web of reciprocity. And it's quite amazing to think that even as we gather here tonight in Montreal, the Mamos of the elder brothers, living just 2 hours by air from Miami Beach, are, as we speak, as we meet, staring out to sea from the heights of the Sierra Nevada, praying for our well-being and the well-being of the entire earth. Now, one's inclination upon hearing such an account is to dismiss it as either being hopelessly naive or so impossibly beautiful as to be untrue. This, sadly, has too often been our response to cultures we encounter but do not understand, whose profound complexities are so dazzling as to overwhelm. When the British reached the shores of Australia, they were utterly unprepared for the sophistication of the place and its inhabitants, utterly incapable of embracing its wonder. They had no understanding of the challenges of the desert and little sensitivity to the achievement of the Aboriginal people who, for over 55,000 years, had thrived on that parsimonious continent as hunters and gatherers and guardians of their world. In all that time, the Aboriginal people were never touched by the desire to improve upon the world, to tame the rhythm of the wild. The Aboriginal people accepted life as it was, a cosmological whole, the unchanging creation of the first dawn, when earth and sky separated, and the original ancestor, the rainbow serpent, brought into being all the primordial ancestors who, through their thoughts, dreams, and journeys, literally sang the world into existence. The ancestors walked as they sang, and when it was time to stop, they slept. And in their dreams, they conceived the events of the following day, points of creation that fused one into another until every creature, every stream and stone, all space and time became part of the whole, the divine manifestation of one great seminal impulse. When they grew exhausted, they retired into the earth, the sky, the clouds, the lakes, the plants, the animals of an island continent that still resonates with their memory. The paths taken by the ancestors have never been forgotten. They are the song lines, precise itineraries followed even today by people who travel across a template of the physical world. As the Aborigines track the songlines and chant the stories of the first dawning, they become part of the ancestors and enter dream time, which is neither a dream nor the measure of a passage of time. It is the very realm of the ancestors, a parallel universe where the ordinary laws of time, space, and motion do not apply, where past, future, and present merge into one. To walk the song lines is to become one with the ongoing creation of the world, a place that both exists and is still being formed. Thus, the Aborigines are not merely attached to the earth, they are essential to its existence. Without the land, they would die. But without the people, the ongoing process of creation would cease and the earth would wither. Through movement and sacred rituals, the people maintain access to dream time and thus play a dynamic and ongoing role in the world of the ancestors even today. But today is both yesterday and tomorrow. A moment begins with nothing. A man or a woman walks, and from emptiness emerge the songs, the musical embodiment of reality, the cosmic melodies that give the world its character. The songs, in turn, create vibrations that take shape. Dancing brings definition to the forms, and the objects of the phenomenological realm suddenly appear. Trees, rocks, streams, all of them physical evidence of the dreaming. Should the ritual stop, the voices fall silent, all would be lost, because everything on earth is held together by the song lines. Everything is subordinate to the dreaming, which is constant but ever-changing. Every landmark on earth is wedded to the memory of its origins, and yet always in the process of being born. Every animal and object resonates with the pulse of an ancient event while still being dreamed into being. The world as it exists is perfect, though constantly in the process of being formed. The land is encoded in everything that ever was, everything that ever will be, in every dimension of reality. Thus, to walk the land for the Aboriginal person is to engage in a constant act of affirmation, an endless dance of creation. In truth, the visionary realm of the Aboriginal peoples of Australia represents one of the great experiments in human thought. I recently spent 6 weeks in the remote reaches of Arnhem Land in the Northern Territory of Australia with a remarkable man, Otto Campion, and his extended family, his wife Christine, his uncle Jeffrey, all the kids, out on the land. I wanted to know about the dreaming and the song lines, something far more than I had managed to distill from books. At first, when I was with them, I, like so many anthropologists, I peppered them with meaningless questions, sought definitions, and then finally, recognizing my folly, I shut up and simply watched. Arriving at a billabong, pond or a slough, a place to camp, Otto and the lads immediately set fire to the grass, both to cleanse and regenerate the site. As they bathe, they beat the water, sending a message to the crocodiles. Then they purified themselves with smoke from ironwood branches and with their hands wrapped a ring of mud and red ochre around the trunk of every tree. In a few gestures, they domesticated the space, sweeping the ground with branches, erecting windbreaks, peeling off great sheets of paper bark from the melaleuca trees to serve as bedding and blankets. The mothers and young children slept in one circle, the elder men in another, and the young single boys in yet a third. When they went after Baramundi fish, they kept up a constant dialogue, describing the nature of their hunger and needs, invoking the ancestors and the spirit of the ancestors of the fish. As we walked the land together, I was astonished not only by the depth of Otto's knowledge, but even more so by his way of knowing. His thinking was completely nonlinear, a sort of magical pattern of what seemed to me to be free association. A trail of ants would lead to sweat bees. A comb of honey dug from the ground would prompt a reference to a mythic bird. then talk of a spirit, which in turn brought us back to the Morning Star Songline, Rock Wallaby Dreaming, and the utility of the paper bark tree, a source of shelter, and so much more. Kapok trees coming into bloom implied that baby kangaroos or joeys had enough hair to survive the death of their mothers. A yellow-red blossom on a tree with a color suggestive of the fat of an emu revealed to Otto somehow the proper time to hunt the long-necked turtle. I came to realize simply by being with Otto and his family that in a sense the Aboriginal people had never been nomadic. To the contrary, they lived locked within their clan territories that had been delineated for all time by their ancestors. Imagine for a moment if all the genius and intellect of all the generations that have come before you had been concentrated on a single set of tasks, focused exclusively on knowing a particular piece of ground, not only the plants and the animals, but every ecological, climactic, geographical detail, the pulse of every sentient creature, the rhythm of every breath of wind, the pattern of every season, the very sounds a plant makes as it grows. This perspicacity, this empirical observation, this genius was the norm in Aboriginal Australia. And what linked all these clan territories was not the physical movement of peoples, but rather the strength of a common idea, a subtle but universal philosophy, a way of thinking. And this was the dreaming. It refers, on one level, as we have seen, to the first dawning, when the rainbow serpent and all the ancestral beings created the world. And it is, of course, remembered in the song lines, which are the trajectories walked by these ancestors as they sang the world into being. But the song lines, as I learned from Otto, are not straight or linear. They do not necessarily even exist in three-dimensional space. But in their numbers, they weave a web across an entire continent. For a civilization that lacked the written word, the song lines became a record of the past, a promise of the future, and a network that in the moment bound together all of the people. The goal of the individual, as Otto taught me, is not to follow the song line from start to finish, as I had thought, but to honor the ancestors at the points of power and memory that mark the passage of a particular song line through one's own clan territory. But critically, the dreaming is not a myth or a memory. It is what happened at the time of creation, but also what happens now, and what will happen for all eternity. In the Aboriginal universe, there is no past, present, or future. In not one of the 670 languages and dialects spoken on that continent did there exist, at the time of contact, a word for time. There is no notion of linear progress, no goal of improvement, no idealization of the possibility of change. To the contrary, the entire logos of the dreaming is stasis, constancy, balance, consistency. The entire purpose of the humanity is to not improve anything. It is to engage the ritual and ceremonial activities deemed to be essential for the maintenance of the world precisely as it was at the moment of creation. Imagine if all of Western intellectual and scientific passion had been focused from the beginning of time, from the beginning of our tradition, on keeping the Garden of Eden precisely as it was when Adam and Eve had their fateful conversation. Now, in our Western tradition, existence is something to be contemplated. Our thinkers and philosophers step outside of life to discern abstract ideas that we then define as insights. The dreaming makes such reflection both meaningless and impossible. The dreaming answered both the questions how and why. It dictated the way a person must live. Man's obligation was not to improve upon nature, but to sustain the world. The literal preservation of the land was the most fundamental priority of every Aboriginal man and woman. It was, of course, a profoundly conservative philosophy and ideology. Now, I'm not here to say whether it was good or bad, right or wrong, but it had consequences. Clearly, had humanity as a whole followed the ways of the Aborigines, the intellectual track laid down by the descendants of the first humans to walk out of Africa, we would not have put a man on the moon. But on the other hand, had the dreaming become a universal devotion, we would not be contemplating today the consequences of industrial processes that, by any scientific definition, threaten the very life supports of the planet. Well, this story tonight, like all narratives, I suppose, weaves its way back to the beginning. And I open this lecture by speaking of the sacred headwaters, this astonishingly beautiful and rare jewel of a valley from which are born the salmon rivers of home. Well, actually, of my home, because the Stikine is where I live. The people of the Stikine River Valley, one of the most remarkable places I've ever known, have rallied against those mining projects I mentioned, for they have a very different notion and way of thinking about the land. For the Tahltan people, the sacred headwaters is a neighborhood, at once their grocery store and sanctuary, their church and schoolyard, their cemetery and country club. They believe that the people with the greatest claim of ownership of that valley are the generations as yet unborn. The sacred headwaters will be their nursery. The Iskut elders, almost all of whom grew up in the land, have formally called for an end to all industrial activity in their valley and the creation of a sacred headwaters tribal heritage area. And indeed, in the end, what is at stake is the future of one of the most extraordinary regions, not only in all of North America, but on the entire planet. The fate of the sacred headwaters transcends the interests of local residents, provincial agencies, mining companies, and those few who would favor industrial development at any cost. No amount of methane gas, copper, or coal can compensate for the sacrifice of a place that can be the sacred headwaters of all Canadians, and indeed for all peoples of the world. This is the message of this evening, and this is the message of the Elder Brothers. Thank you very much.
From Pollock Hall in Montreal, you've been listening to Sacred Geography, the fourth of the 2009 CBC Massey Lectures by Wade Davis. The book of the 2009 Massey Lectures is published by House of Anansi Press and is available across Canada. You can purchase The Wayfinders, Why Ancient Wisdom Matters in the Modern World, either as a book or CD, by going to the Ideas website, cbc.ca/ideas. Tonight's lecture was recorded in Montreal by Jane Lewis with recording engineer Pierre Levesque. The 2009 CBC Massey Lectures were produced for Ideas by Philip Coulter. The CBC Massey Lectures are co-sponsored by CBC Radio, the House of Anansi Press, and Massey College in the University of Toronto. The executive producer of Ideas is Bernie Lucht. I'm Paul Kennedy. Please stay tuned to CBC Radio 1 and to Sirius Satellite Radio for the hourly news.